The CBS News Weekend Roundup after this short break.
Not available in all states.
Hey, Tracy, heard you started your own business.
Yep, a Reese and Irvy's frozen yogurt vending franchise. It's the latest revolution in healthy frozen yogurt. My robots...
Wait, your robots?
Yep, my robots deliver 7 flavors of delicious and healthy frozen yogurt to customers in high-traffic locations. And Reese and Irvy's provides everything we need to succeed.
And the robots do the work.
They work, so I don't have to.
How can I get my own robots?
Simply go to froyofranchising.com, enter promo code 1616, and submit your information. That's froyofranchising.com, promo code 1616.
This is the CBS News Weekend Roundup. Ben Carson defends his stance on poverty.
Attitude helps tremendously.
And visiting a D-Day landmark.
It is an American pilgrimage to the place where thousands of Americans died.
Later, cashing in on black branding.
Developers are branding their buildings after iconic African Americans.
I'm Steve Dorsey at the CBS News Washington Bureau. Let's start this weekend with Housing and Urban Development Secretary Dr. Ben Carson. Secretary Carson, thanks for talking with us.
My pleasure.
So you've been on the job for 3 months now, almost 100 days. What difference have you made in the lives of the poor?
Well, we've removed a lot of the regulatory burdens that keep the public housing authorities from being able to do things efficiently. And, you know, we're looking at pushing things that allow more economic development, for instance, Section 3, which requires that any large building project or rehab project that's receiving public funding hire and train the local talent.
If we went to a housing project, say in Baltimore, D.C., Chicago, New York, wherever, what do you think they would say about the job that you've done so far?
Well, I don't think they would know a whole lot about it so far because they haven't been there for very long. But, you know, we're going to be doing a lot more public engagements so that people actually do know what's going on. You know, part of the problem with the housing crisis that occurred back in 2008 is that people didn't know. Therefore, they were taken advantage of. They didn't understand that you don't buy a house that costs more than 2.5 times your annual salary. They were taken in by people saying the price of your house is going to continually go up, and therefore you can borrow against it. And those are the kinds of things that we're making big changes in.
But some would say the regulations in the aftermath of that help combat that from happening again in the future.
Absolutely. Some of those regulations are very important. When I talk about decreasing regulatory burden, I'm not talking about the regulations that really help and protect the populace. I'm talking about the stacked-on regulations that are put on without thinking to replace another thing without taking away the thing that it's replacing.
So you want people to be more self-sufficient. We know that. That's part of your philosophy leading HUD. Last month, though, you said during an interview, you think poverty to a large extent is also a state of mind. Do you regret that?
Not at all. The fact of the matter is the way people approach things. I'm not saying that everybody who's in poverty has a bad state of mind. What I'm saying is that when you develop the right kind of thinking, you approach things differently. That's what I'm talking about. The human brain and the mindset plays a very important role in the way that we approach things.
So is it a matter of attitude then?
Attitude helps tremendously, and that's one of the reasons that we're working so hard to make sure that people have the right kinds of attitudes, putting into place the kinds of things that allow people to ascend the ladder of opportunity rather than to remain in a complacent situation. You know, we have 3 to 4 times as many people, for instance, in need of affordable housing as we're able to provide. As we're able to move people out of public housing, we are able to help many other people. So we need to be thinking about it that way, not how many people we can get into public housing, but how many can we get out of it.
How do you change the minds, though, of folks that say, I want to be out of poverty. I believe in myself. I believe in a better future for my family, but I just can't get out of where I am right now.
Yeah, well, we can help them, though. That's one of the reasons that we're looking at the concept of vision/opportunity centers. Places that we put into neighborhoods can be a repurposed abandoned school where we teach people what opportunities exist. We need to be creating a mechanism for mentorship programs. There are a lot of good people out there who would be glad to be mentors if they had a good mechanism whereby to do it. We need to provide appropriate types of child care because so many of the young women have had babies out of wedlock and their education ends at that point. We need to allow them an opportunity to get their GED, to get their associate's degree, their bachelor's degree, their master's degree, learn to take control of their own lives and teach that to their children. That's the way we break these cycles. We don't just keep throwing money at it.
Let's talk about HUD's budget. The White House is proposing to cut it by something like 15%. That's more than $7 billion. So that could affect how many and how much housing vouchers HUD gives out. What do you tell the folks who worry their home might be on the line?
Would I love it if we had unlimited funds and we could just take care of everybody? That would be absolutely spectacular. But that's not the case. So what we do instead is we make the best of situation in which we once again impose some fiscal responsibility. We obviously will take into account the people who are most vulnerable, and we're going to roll out the programs and the regulations in a responsible manner, but bringing efficiency to the program, will save us an enormous amount of money.
All right, finally, Meals on Wheels. This is one of the programs that gets funding from HUD and these community block grants. Budget Director Mick Mulvaney, as you know, described it as one of those programs not delivering results. Do you agree with him?
The way I kind of look at it, we have to look at a new paradigm. The old paradigm, the government rides in on a white horse and throws money at problems. The new paradigm, the government comes in, seeds the program, and helps the local authorities to establish public-private partnerships. And local people take control of the issues that are going on in their community and help to solve them. There's a lot more money in the private sector than there is in the government. And you look around the country at some of these blighted neighborhoods that have been turned into beautiful places. Those have been done with public-private partnerships. This is what we have to begin to push and create win-win situations for everybody.
But certainly Meals on Wheels does get private money donations. Do you think it's a good investment, though, of public money?
I think public money can seed the program, but as you accurately point out, the vast majority of it comes through the private sector. There's a great place for the faith community, and, you know, this is what we're supposed to do. We've always been compassionate people. We've taken care of the people around us. We need to continue to do that.
Housing and Urban Development Secretary Ben Carson, you're always welcome back.
Thank you, sir.
Still to come, the fight on climate change. That's next on the Weekend Roundup. On the CBS News Weekend Roundup, I'm Steve Dorsey. Former FBI Director James Comey is due to appear Thursday before the Senate Intelligence Committee to detail Oval Office conversations he had with President Trump. But will the president try to stop him? Here's CBS News White House correspondent Stephen Portnoy.
The hearing set for Thursday is on track to be one of Washington's most highly anticipated events in years. But there's a lingering question as to whether the White House might try to block James Comey's testimony. It would be a novel application of executive privilege, since Comey actually wants to share what Mr. Trump said about the FBI's investigation into former National Security Advisor Michael Flynn. A senior White House advisor says a decision to invoke the privilege would be up to the president, but that aides here do intend to watch Comey's testimony.
The White House is asking the Supreme Court to reinstate the president's travel ban that targets six mostly Muslim countries. More from CBS News senior legal analyst Andrew Cohen.
The feds are making essentially the same arguments they've been making for months, the same arguments that have been losing in the lower federal courts, that the ban is legal, that the court should defer to the president on national security and immigration, and that all the discriminatory talk of a Muslim ban is irrelevant to the legal analysis.
The White House is facing more fallout from the president's decision to withdraw the U.S. from that big Paris climate deal that aims to fight global warming. More from correspondent Major Garrett.
President Trump portrayed his decision to abandon the Paris Climate Agreement as a rescue mission for the American worker, not an abdication of U.S. leadership on green technology or efforts to slow global warming.
The Paris Climate Accord is simply the latest example of Washington entering into an agreement that disadvantages the United States.
The president said the voluntary pact placed too many restrictions on greenhouse gas emissions and committed U.S. tax dollars to help less developed nations reduce pollution.
I was elected to represent the citizens of Pittsburgh, not Paris.
Mr. Trump has called global warming a hoax.
A lot of it's a hoax. It's a hoax.
Though he said nothing about the science of climate change in the Rose Garden. Robert Iger, chairman of Disney, and Elon Musk, CEO of Tesla, announced their resignations from the president's Business Advisory Council to protest the Paris withdrawal. Said Musk on Twitter, "Climate change is real. Leaving Paris is not good for America or the world." Former President Obama, who helped seal the climate deal in Paris 2 years ago, did not explicitly name Mr. Trump, but in a statement sent during Mr. Trump's announcement said, "Even in the absence of American leadership, even as this administration joins a small handful of nations that reject the future, I'm confident that our states, cities, and businesses will step up."
We don't want other leaders and other countries laughing at us anymore.
The president said under the agreement, China and India would continue to pollute by using coal, while the U.S. would be forced to limit coal-fired plants and other fossil fuel use. All, he said, to curry favor with environmental elites.
It is time to make America great again. Thank you.
Despite the president's claims, environmental protection groups say India and China have both moved away from coal and embraced renewable energy sources.
Major Garrett reporting, the U.S. joins just two other countries that didn't sign the agreement, Nicaragua and Syria. In response to the president's decision, monuments and landmarks around the world have been lit in green in support of the international accord. Correspondent Ben Tracy in China has more on the world's reaction.
China is the biggest polluter on the planet. But now its state-owned tabloid is calling the U.S. withdrawal reckless and said America's selfishness and irresponsibility would hurt its global standing. Reaction from around the world was swift. German Chancellor Angela Merkel called it extremely regrettable. Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau called it disheartening. And the Vatican went further, saying Mr. Trump's decision was a disaster for everyone. Paris bathed its city hall in green lights, and French President Emmanuel Macron made a forceful speech in English.
It is an actual mistake, both for the U.S. and for our planet.
After meeting with President Trump last week in Europe, Macron used the president's own words against him.
We all share the same responsibility. Make our planet great again.
Germany, France, and Italy issued a rare joint statement calling the Paris Accord irreversible and stating it cannot be renegotiated. That was a blunt rejection of President Trump's assertion that he will eventually negotiate a better deal on climate. The president is fundamentally shifting alliances around the world. The Chinese premier visited Germany and Brussels this week to forge a closer relationship with Europe. China plans to spend more than $360 billion on renewable energy by 2020, which it says will create at least 13 million new jobs.
Ben Tracy reporting from Beijing. President Trump did sign a waiver that keeps the U.S. Embassy in Israel in Tel Aviv. For now, despite campaign promises that Mr. Trump would move it to Jerusalem, the president said it could have a negative impact on efforts to promote peace between Israelis and Palestinians. But the White House insists the president isn't abandoning his pledge. Staying overseas, anti-government protesters clashed with police in Afghanistan's capital, Kabul, Friday. Four protesters were killed. Public anger has boiled over in response to an explosives-laden sewage tanker that militants detonated in the city's diplomatic quarter on Wednesday. It killed 90 people and wounded hundreds of others. It was the deadliest attack in Kabul since 2001. Human rights activist Ahmad Sharifi.
People are really losing hope. Every day, Afghans are dying, either in the provinces or in Kabul or anywhere, in the schools, in their hospitals, in their mosques. So there is no safe place for them.
In the Philippines, dozens are dead at a resort in Manila after a gunman stormed the casino, lighting gambling tables on fire. The suspect was found dead of an apparent suicide, along with $2 million in gambling chips that he stole. But authorities say it was a robbery, not a terror attack. Russian President Vladimir Putin says it's plausible private Russian hackers could have been involved in cyber attacks to help the presidential campaign of President Trump last year. In comments made to reporters in St. Petersburg, Putin said those private hackers could have been, quote, patriotically minded. But Putin denied any state role in the hacking. Reporter Alec Loon has more from Moscow.
It's not Kremlin agents, but independent Russian hackers who could be responsible for cyber attacks on Western elections, Vladimir Putin has said. When asked about the security of upcoming elections in Germany, Putin said patriotic hackers could decide to take revenge on those who criticize Russia. U.S. intelligence has accused Moscow of hacking Democratic Party emails last year.
Scammers take aim at the Ariana Grande benefit concert for victims of the Manchester bombing.
More than 10,000 scammers tried to get free tickets to Sunday's Manchester charity concert reserved for fans at the Ariana Grande event hit by a suicide bomber. Online agency Ticketmaster blocked those it describes as unscrupulous, opportunists, and scalpers. Proceeds from the Love Manchester concert will go to the wounded and the families of those killed. Larry Miller, CBS News, London.
Up next,
you are about to embark upon the Great Crusade.
Remembering D-Day on the CBS News Weekend Roundup.
The CBS News Weekend Roundup after this short break.
Are you hiring? Do you know where to post your job to find the best candidates? With ZipRecruiter, you can post your job to 100-plus job sites with just one click. Then their powerful technology efficiently matches the right people to your job better than anyone else. That's why ZipRecruiter is different. Unlike other job sites, ZipRecruiter doesn't depend on candidates finding you. It finds them. In fact, over 80% of jobs posted on ZipRecruiter get a qualified candidate in just 24 hours. No juggling emails or calls to your office. Simply screen, rate, and manage candidates all in one place with ZipRecruiter's easy-to-use dashboard. Find out today why ZipRecruiter has been used by businesses of all sizes to find the most qualified job candidates with immediate results. And right now, our listeners can post jobs on ZipRecruiter for free. That's right, free. Just go to ZipRecruiter.com/free trial. That's ZipRecruiter.com/free trial. One more time to try it for free. Go to ZipRecruiter.com/free trial.
On the CBS News Weekend Roundup, I'm Steve Dorsey. On Tuesday, the world marks an unforgettable day in its long history, D-Day. And this weekend, our Steve Futterman visits the beaches of Normandy, speaking with some of the children of those soldiers who took part in the push to retake Europe in World War II.
Every year they come.
I've just managed to find the website that lists all the Silver Star recipients, and he's listed.
It is an American pilgrimage to the place where thousands of Americans died.
It's not like I'm walking in his footsteps, but I feel like I'm in the neighborhood of his history.
This year is the 73rd anniversary of D-Day, June 6, 1944, the start of the greatest military invasion in history.
Soldiers, sailors, and airmen of the Allied Expeditionary Force, you are about to embark upon the Great Crusade, toward which we have striven these many months. The eyes of the world are upon you.
Wherever you go in this area, there are reminders of what took place here. There are many American flags. There's the Franklin Roosevelt Cafe. There are the famous beaches, Omaha Beach, Utah Beach. And there are reminders of the German occupying soldiers.
The huge concrete casement that you see out here, with the National Guard monument on top, it still has the original gun inside, an 88mm anti-tank gun. Facing east.
Tours occur every day throughout the year.
The first troops to land on the beaches would be engineers. They were to destroy beach obstacles. There were 4,000 obstacles on this beach alone. Obstacles that looked like this.
It can be emotional for many who come here for closure. This woman's father was part of the D-Day invasion.
I knew he was involved, and I didn't know much. I was the daughter, and it was a different time in the world. He didn't share it, and they didn't share it. I don't think World War II vets really shared the story very much. He was a very silent sort of guy.
Tom Miller came to the Normandy beaches in March.
I know you respect your dad, but even more so today.
Oh, sure. Now, seeing actually what he went through,
although he never really wanted to talk a whole lot about it. You know, I think this, in that respect, helps me complete that experience, seeing, you know, where it was and what he experienced. He was a sergeant in the Army.
Okay.
And
first day? Was he here on the first day?
Or? He was here on the first day on Utah Beach. He was in the Tough Hombres, which I found out was the 90th, I believe, Division 357th.
Did he ever talk about the luck he had of just surviving?
Oh, yeah, he felt lucky. You know, a lot of things he talked about was just the severity of sitting in the boats all night on the channel, the great explosions and all the heavy armament that was fired over their heads that day.
The most solemn, sacred spot for Americans is the U.S. cemetery. And every day, at the end of the day, they play taps as the American flag is lowered.
We will accept nothing less than full victory. Good luck. And let us all beseech the blessing of Almighty God upon this great and noble undertaking.
For the CBS News Weekend Roundup, I'm Steve Futterman.
Last Thursday marked the start of hurricane season in the U.S.
I'm Peter King. The government seasonal forecast calls for as many as 17 named storms, up to 9 hurricanes, and as many as 4 majors. National Hurricane Center senior specialist Dan Brown says that forecast doesn't really matter much.
The seasonal forecast doesn't tell you where the storms are going to form or where they're going to go. It just means it's time to be ready.
That means stocking up on supplies and watching the tropics if you live along the Atlantic or Gulf coasts.
We have to be prepared each and every season. We don't know if that one storm is going to hit us this year or not.
Brown says the 5-day forecasts are becoming more accurate, and this year the new GOES-R satellite is expected to provide faster, high-definition pictures of developing storms.
We're going to get a lot more higher resolution images as well as a lot more frequent satellite pictures.
Hurricane specialist John Cangelosi says the new satellite will provide more pictures and more details faster.
It's like we now have HD satellite, essentially.
Peter King, CBS News, Orlando.
New York drivers may soon face a new test for distracted driving. More from correspondent Jeff Glore.
My wife and I got that call that every parent dreads.
In 2011, Ben Lieberman's 19-year-old son was in the backseat of a car when it was hit head-on. Evan Lieberman eventually died of massive internal injuries. Ben Lieberman filed a civil suit and subpoenaed the driver's cell phone records. They revealed the driver had been texting around the time of the accident. His license was eventually suspended for a year.
You think distracted driving should be looked at the same way drunk driving is?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a great model.
46 states have banned texting while driving, but it's an act that's exceedingly difficult to prove without a confession or an eyewitness. That could change if New York okays a bill that's already passed the Senate that allows police to field test for cell phone use after an accident.
You call these extractions?
Yes.
Jim Grady is the CEO of Cellebrite, which helps police analyze phones in criminal cases.
So I just sent a text message to my friend.
He showed us a device they call the Textalizer.
So there's your SMS.
When connected to a phone, the program can tell whether someone's been typing or swiping.
And if that is the time right before the accident, that's not good for you.
The Textalizer is designed so the driver's phone never leaves their hands. And because it scans operating system logs, Cellebrite says it won't give anyone access to private information. Rashida Richardson and the New York Civil Liberties Union believe the law is being rushed.
They say that it will just scan to see if it was in use, but there's many ways that scan can actually collect private information.
Jeff Glore, CBS News, New York.
From the roads to the skies, and a new way to fight jet lag.
It's billed as an easy cure for jet lag. That's where your body clock is thrown off by a change in time zones, making you want to sleep when you should be awake. Well, British researchers have found that postponing meals can quickly bring your circadian rhythms back into sync. It works by delaying how blood sugar levels fluctuate through the day, regulating sugar metabolism without any need for drugs. The first step is to delay meals, starting with breakfast, for 5 hours after waking. The study authors say the technique can also work for workers who change shifts. Jim Shenavy, CBS News.
Some of the belongings of one Rolling Stones icon go to the auction block.
Rolling Stones guitarist Keith Richards and his wife, Patty Hansen, donating items from their Manhattan apartment to benefit a couple of Connecticut charities that help autistic adults. And not a lot of rock on the auction block, mostly apartment stuff like furniture and carpets and paintings. One item that seems appropriate, an English tea set covered with skulls. Auction later this month. Jim Taylor, CBS News.
Coming up on the weekend roundup, gentrification in America's changing cities.
There is a lack of social interaction among the newcomers and the long-term residents, some which is based on race.
Follow us on Twitter. We've got headlines at CBS Radio News. And I'm tweeting at Steve_Dorsey on the CBS News Weekend Roundup. On the CBS News Weekend Roundup, I'm Steve Dorsey. You may have seen the news over the past week about developers in Harlem proposing to change its name to SoHa, short for South Harlem. As you can imagine, that has not gone over well with community leaders who worry gentrification is steamrolling over Black history and culture. Of course, that struggle is playing out in cities across the U.S., especially here in Washington. I spoke with Derek Hira, author of the new book, Race, Class, and Politics, in the Cappuccino City. We met up at a bar in the neighborhood his book is about, Shaw.
This area, we're at 11th and O, which is one block away from 11th and M, where Elliot Leibo wrote Tally's Corner, which was a famous ethnography about the Shaw U Street area that took place in the late 1960s. And this is when the area was highly concentrated in poverty. It was over 90% African American. And now you've seen dramatic transformation in the demographics, not only with race, but also with income. This area in 2010 is majority white. 55% of the residents are Caucasian. You've seen a tremendous amount of economic revitalization, which is basically symbolized in the amenities of the place that we're at right now. They've got high-end cocktails. The music's playing in the background, and this is one of the new bars that really caters to the millennials who have more recently in the last 10 years moved into this neighborhood and pretty much taken it over.
Tell me about your book.
The book looks at the transformation of the Shaw U Street area, which I said is a historic African-American community. It was known once as Black Broadway in the 1920s to the 1940s. It had a tremendous concentration of entertainers, but also academics and scholars from Howard University. Some of the first PhDs from Harvard, Yale, and the University of Chicago were teaching at Howard University and living in the Shaw U Street neighborhood. And that's what gave the neighborhood its rich depth in Black culture. But since that time, the neighborhood in the 50s, 60s, and 70s, even in the 80s, was on the decline. But in the 90s and 2000s, again, this area has seen a tremendous amount of economic revitalization. And the book tries to look at and explore what are the drivers of gentrification, but also the implications for long-term residents.
Your book uses that rich Black history as an example of what you call Black branding.
In the past, in the United States, when a neighborhood was branded Black, it led to white flight. It led to economic decline. But we've seen in the 90s with the branding of Harlem, which has always had a brand, the South Side of Chicago and Bronzeville, but also in the Shaw U Street area here in Washington, D.C., developers are branding their buildings after iconic African Americans. We've got the Langston Lofts here after Langston Hughes. Also, Busboys and Poets is in that same building, which is a well-known restaurant here in D.C. that plays homage to Langston Hughes. You also have the Ellington Apartments. You have Marvin's, which is a restaurant named after Marvin Gaye, who grew up here in Washington, D.C. So it's pretty much impossible to walk anywhere in this neighborhood and not understand the rich history in African-American culture that's associated with it.
There's rich history, there's rich Black culture here, but it's now majority white. How has that affected this neighborhood?
That's sort of the irony. But also it speaks to maybe progress that we've made in race relations. I mean, you have a group of white millennials who are professionals who are moving here in part because of that history. They appreciate that history. They know it. They want to engage with it. But at the same time, you also have difficulty with the millennials interacting with the long-term African American residents who are still here, who majority are living in subsidized housing. Many of them make $20,000 and under, while the majority of people who have moved here are making $75,000 and over. So you have big income disparities, and there is a lack of social interaction among the newcomers and the long-term residents, some which is based on race, but some which is also based on income differences. And really, with our country, it's trying to figure out how we can make mixed-income, mixed-race communities work, not only for long-term residents, but also for the newcomers. And what we've seen in this community is a revitalization that is also associated with a tremendous amount of conflict. There's been political and cultural displacement that has happened for the long-term residents who are able to stay in the subsidized housing. And this book really tries to grapple with that conflict, but also think about what are the ways we could resolve that? How could we make this community work better for everybody who's here?
Can this neighborhood work in Dallas? Can this neighborhood work in Indianapolis with different housing structures and laws that are kind of unique to D.C.?
What we're seeing in the United States is that there are inner city areas that are concentrated in poverty, that have been African American, that are just on the cusp of the central business districts. This is where, you know, in the 40s, 50s, and 60s, a lot of public housing was placed. Now a lot of that housing stock is being demolished, and that is also associated with the revitalization we're seeing, not necessarily here in D.C., but around the country. So you're seeing places like Treme in New Orleans. You're seeing Sweet Auburn in Atlanta. You're seeing Roxbury in Boston. These are all areas that were historic black areas that are gentrifying. So I think a lot of the things that we're seeing in Shaw U Street do generalize to those other areas. And I think to make those areas work for everybody, we need to maintain the subsidized housing stock that is there. But we also need to think about how do we build bridges among populations that have traditionally been segregated in the United States.
Derek Hyra, professor at American University and author of Race, Class, and Politics in the Cappuccino City. Some cities are working to breathe new life into dead malls, as correspondent Meg Oliver reports.
Everybody saw it as a dead mall.
This used to be the site of the old Granite Run Mall outside Philadelphia.
This used to be like the food court.
This was very close to the food court.
Developer Michael Markman is giving the area a 21st century makeover.
What makes it different?
You know, what's different about this is, so there's a lot of malls being redeveloped around the country because malls are dying everywhere. What we did was really, really aggressive. We took down the whole interior portion of the mall.
First building B.
Markman is going to replace the old mall with a complex of buildings for shopping, entertainment, apartments, and a healthcare facility.
We have about twice as much retail square footage per capita than any other country in the world.
Architecture professor Ellen Dunham Jones says reimagining old malls is becoming a necessity. It's estimated there are about 1,000 malls across the country. Around one-third are at risk of failing. In Rhode Island, the historic Westminster Arcade found new life after adding apartments to the second floor. An old strip mall in Tennessee was converted into a church. And the 100 Oaks Mall in Nashville survived after Vanderbilt constructed a health facility next to the stores.
We see a lot of malls that are turned into medical clinics, turned into community colleges, or any all range of educational facilities.
This is the future.
Markman says the first phase of the new property is set to open in May 2018. Meg Oliver, CBS News Media, Pennsylvania.
Coming up, spelling the way to victory on the CBS News Weekend Roundup.
The CBS News Weekend Roundup after this short break.
Does your dad love to grill but hates the hassle and poor quality at the grocery store? We have the perfect Father's Day gift, Omaha Steaks. This Father's Day, for only $49.99, you can get a limited time Father's Day package when you go to omahasteaks.com and enter FTN in the search bar to apply the savings. Right now, Omaha Steaks is giving a limited time offer to our listeners for Father's Day. This is really an amazing deal. You will get 80% off Omaha Steaks Father's Day package, which includes 2 tender mild filet mignons, 2 bold beefy top sirloins, 4 crispy chicken fried steaks, 4 juicy boneless pork chops, 4 all beef Omaha Steak burgers, 4 award-winning gourmet jumbo franks, 12 ounces of all beef meatballs, 1 pound of steakhouse fries, 4 made-from-scratch caramel apple tartlets, 1 Omaha Steak seasoning packet,
Plus, get 4 additional burgers for free. This offer ends soon. Go to omahasteaks.com, type FTN in the search bar, grab your dad, and fire up the grill.
On the CBS News Weekend Roundup, I'm Steve Dorsey. In Florida, health officials there say they've confirmed at least a dozen cases of a disease affecting dogs.
Stephanie Manginelli is proud of her French Mastiffs. They won numerous top awards at last weekend's show. But several dogs apparently took home something else, the dog flu. Stephanie's dogs seem healthy, but the vet tech decided to vaccinate them anyway.
You took the precaution today.
Yes, we did. We gave her her vaccine today, and her next show in a couple weeks, she'll be nice and protected.
The virus first appeared in the U.S. 2 years ago, with over 1,000 confirmed cases in the Chicago area. At least 5 dogs died. The H3N2 strain has since appeared in 30 states. The illness is rarely fatal, but causes sneezing, coughing, and nasal discharge.
It's highly contagious.
Melissa Lawson is a vet tech at a clinic in DeLand.
Which pet owners need to worry?
Any pet owners that bring their dogs to dog parks, grooming facilities, boarding facilities, dog shows, if they have a very active lifestyle where they take their dog a lot out, then they should.
There's an imminent threat for dogs to be exposed to this virus.
On Thursday, scientists at the University of Florida urged dog owners here to consider getting their pets vaccinated.
The more dogs in a community that we can vaccinate, the better chance we have of keeping this virus out of the community.
But skeptics say the alarm is overstated. Dana Scott of Dogs Naturally magazine thinks pets are over-medicated and drug companies profit.
I think when it comes to vaccination, what you really need to think about is where are these reports coming from? It's basically the vaccine manufacturers that are keeping track of these diseases, and we're relying on the vaccine manufacturers to convey that information to us.
Let's go, Chloe.
Ken Mattson isn't vaccinating 8-year-old Chloe for now, but is trying to limit close contact with other dogs.
It's a major concern, but it's just something you would keep an eye on at this point.
Correspondent Omar Villafranco reporting. Makers of robocall technology, we all hate them, are asking the government for help getting your attention.
This is Susan with Credit Card Relief.
You qualify for a 75% savings.
Marketing calls usually make your cell phone ring. But if the FCC rules in the company's favor, those credit card financing and debt collection calls could legally go straight to your voicemail box in unlimited numbers. Marketers like Josh Justice, who runs ringless voicemail firm Stratix Networks, say that's a good thing. Why?
You go to put your baby to bed, and your phone rings, and you're being solicited something. A ringless voicemail drops is a non-intrusive alternative to this robocall.
The companies are arguing to the FCC that since the phone never actually rings, that their ringless voicemail should not be regulated by the 1991 Telephone Consumer Protection Act, a move supported by the Republican National Committee, which said regulating the practice might affect political outreach campaigns.
That's even more invasive, more time-consuming, and more annoying in some ways than a standard phone call.
Consumer advocates say not regulating would be the wrong call. Margot Saunders is with the National Consumer Law Center.
And they want to be able to reach us without consent, and they want to be able to reach us without our telling them stop.
The FCC does not comment on open petitions, but Chairman Ajit Pai told us recently about robocalls in general.
This is the number one source of consumer complaints to the FCC. It dwarfs anything else that we get.
That's correspondent Anna Werner reporting. A Hawaiian treat is taking over the mainland.
Millions of tourists visit Hawaii each year seeking sun and sea breezes. Increasingly, they also come for poke.
Wonderful.
Really good. It's good. Really good.
The flavor-packed concoction of raw fish is an essential part of the diet for Hawaiians. At Merriman's restaurant on Kauai's Poipu Beach, Chef Mark Ariola is a poke perfectionist.
Good.
Yeah, you've done it, Chef.
Huh? I've made it.
As poke has risen in prominence, poke places are popping up across the country. In Illinois, Zach Friedlander is hoping to take his Aloha Poke Company nationwide by the end of the year.
It's a healthier way to eat. It's revolutionizing the way people eat fast food, the way people look at fast food.
But others find it just a little bit fishy.
I've looked at some of the menus, and I've looked at some of the things, and there's
we don't throw pineapple and bananas and all kinds of, I've seen some weird variations of stuff where I'm like, what is that?
But what also worries Chef Ariola is that the new popularity of poke could lead to overfishing. A 2016 study by the UN reported that nearly 90% of fish stocks are fully fished or overfished.
You don't know until they don't show up anymore.
I don't necessarily think that we're going to put a dent in the fishing industry with the amount of restaurants we're opening.
The Aloha Poke Company, like many others, says it uses sustainable suppliers and methods to make sure the fish and the business stick around for a long time. John Blackstone, Kauai.
We end this weekend with some nail-biting moments on ESPN Thursday night as one middle schooler from Fresno, California fought her way to victory in the 90th Scripps National Spelling Bee. Correspondent Jen Crawford was there.
Chifunkta.
Kodoshimiri.
Haligansheim.
Neasi.
Sesedomaya.
That is correct.
In a fast-paced and suspenseful volley of words, Ananya Vinay and Rohan Rajiv fought to the finish.
That is correct.
Some words were easier to spell than they are to say.
Chiropomphalex.
The finalists were two of 40 contestants whose road to the trophy began 13 hours earlier.
Ah, dang it.
Correct.
What?
The competition tapered off as the words became more difficult.
You really have to give me a word I know right now. Really.
Some spellers became more apprehensive.
Are you ready?
Think so.
Others more confident.
M-O-G-O-L-L-O-N.
Correct.
Whoa.
Ananya had her own method. Keep calm and ask every question.
Part of speech?
Noun.
Can you please repeat the word?
After 20 intense rounds one-on-one, Rohan was stumped.
Merum, M-A-R-E-M, Merum.
But to win, Ananya needed to get two more words right.
A-R-O.
She aced both.
I-N, Merum.
That is correct.
Congratulations, Ananya.
Her father, who rushed the stage after the final word, said he wasn't surprised.
Because I knew she was going to win this year. She came here to win, and she won it.
Now Ananya is faced with one final question, where to put her trophy.
Well, let's see if I can find a space.
Jen Crawford reporting. One other competitor, 6-year-old Edith Fuller, also took the spotlight this year. She was the Bee's youngest ever speller. That does it for the Weekend Roundup. Thanks for listening. We want to get your feedback. Send us your story ideas, autograph requests, home remedies, whatever, to weekendroundup at cbsnews.com. The show's always online on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, Stitcher, and now Spotify. The Weekend Roundup is produced at the CBS News Washington Bureau. Lou Walker is the technical supervisor. Dory Valerio is the production assistant in New York. Have a great week. I'm Steve Dorsey, CBS News.